We're back in Philippians chapter 1, Philippians 1 verses 12 to 26. As we've gone through the book of the Philippians, we've been learning valuable lessons about how churches grow. So back in the first week in this series, we looked at Acts 16, where the church in Philippi was formed. And what we saw was that Philippi is a city was built on shows of aggression and strength, that it was a Roman colony. So the only way of growth they really had ever seen or known was by emperors slaughtering their opposition, destroying every rival who got in their way, even people within their own family. It was brutal. But we saw that the church in Philippi started and then grew in a completely different way, that God's Spirit works as his people obey. And then the second week we looked at verses 1 to 11 and we saw that God's people are called to agape love, sacrificial, selfless love, and that love can abound more and more and more. So now we're up to verses 12 to 26. Now, how did the Roman Empire grow? You know something of your history. I've talked about the brutality, the conquest. One of the things that Romans are still well known for today is their road building prowess. It was one of the things that allowed them to expand in the way they did and move their soldiers from place to place so quickly. As they invaded new territories, they'd build roads as they went. So you can imagine the army marching forward. And then a few miles further up the road are these road engineers clearing the path of obstacles, getting rid of debris, so that the army can march straight through without even stopping to catch their breath. If only building churches was like that. If only the church was a well-oiled machine where everything you achieved succeeded. Every test was passed with flying colours. Actually, the reality is there are obstacles, many obstacles, in the path of churches. They block progress. They make us find another route. We have to do something different. If only the Christian life was as smooth as that, that someone else is in front just smoothing over everything for us, and all I have to do is just saunter on down this perfectly built road. But actually, our lives throw us curveballs. Unexpected things happen. There are obstacles in the path that we have to deal with. We come across roadblock after roadblock. But here's what God, through Paul, as Paul's writing these verses here, here's what God wants us to know from these verses. What looks like a roadblock is actually a stepping stone. So imagine the picture. Imagine you've gone for a walk in the countryside. You come across what looks like, well, it's not even just a puddle, it's a huge lake in the middle of the path. And you haven't got any wellies on, so as you wade on through, you get completely soaked. But by the end of the walk, you realise, do you know what? That lake was actually there to cool my feet down. My feet would be so hot and sweaty by now, but you didn't realise it at the time. That's the key thought in verse 12. Verse 12, I think, in some ways is the key verse to what we're looking at tonight. But Paul says, I want you to know, brethren, that the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel. And then he gives us three areas that would appear at first glance to be roadblocks, but are actually stepping stones, strategically placed so that God's kingdom can grow. So here's the first one. Here's the first roadblock. It's Paul's chains. And that's verses 12 to 14. Paul's chains. Verse 12, he talks about the things which happened to me. But he's actually being very understated here, because do you know what? An awful lot has happened to Paul. He doesn't go into the detail, but we do know some of these details. It's very likely Paul's writing this letter while he's in prison in Rome, and he's writing to the Philippian church, and the events leading up to that are described in Acts 21 to 28. So we actually know quite a bit of what he's talking about here. Back in Acts 21, there were some Jewish people who accused him of false teaching. They accused him of defiling the temple by bringing a Greek man into it. And that wasn't true. They just had it in for him. So what happens is a crowd of people drag him out of the temple and they want to kill him, only for an official to step in and rescue him. But Paul has to stand trial. He's scourged, he's whipped with a leather whip made of bone and metal. And he's sent on to Caesarea. And he has to stand trial again before Governor Felix. And then he has to explain himself to Felix's replacement, Paul Festus. And then the same with King Agrippa. He's being passed from ruler to the next, ruler to the next. And then he has to go to Rome to stand trial there as well. But the voyage there isn't straightforward. He gets shipwrecked. They get caught in a storm. And they end up on the island of Malta. And they have to stay there for months. And in the midst of the shipwreck, actually, what the people had been planning to do was kill all the prisoners. So Paul, as he sees this storm, again, he doesn't know if he's going to live or die here. They eventually reach Rome, and he's going to be tried. He's now waiting to be tried by Emperor Nero. What a waste of time all that was. Think of all the missionary journeys Paul could have been on in that time. Think of all the sermons he could have preached in Jerusalem, Athens, or all the other key strategic cities. Think of all the churches he could have visited, all the letters he could have written, all the teaching he could have done, the books he could have written. But instead he's in prison, then in prison, then in prison, then on a boat, then back in prison. But Paul doesn't see it as a waste of time. We probably would. Paul says, actually, I know that's how other people will view it. That's why he says these things have actually turned out to further the gospel. But why does he see it that way? Well, he sees two groups of people who have benefited, and he tells us about them. Firstly, he tells us about the palace guard. In verse 13, he says, it's become evident to the whole palace guard and to all the rest that my chains are in Christ. And the palace guard are some of the toughest, meanest of all the Roman soldiers. So they're guarding Paul. They're probably on rotation. So there's a couple of guards and then they go off and the next couple come in and so on. But what they would have seen is not just the way he lived. They would have seen his conversations. Maybe they heard him singing. I don't know the details, but they realised this man's not there for his crimes. He's there for his Christ. This man's the real deal. He says, not only have they seen it, he says, and all the rest have seen it too. And when he talks about all the rest, I don't know if he means by that the rest of the Roman army, or the rest of the people who live in the palace, or maybe just the whole population of Rome. It could be any of those. But either way, you get his point, don't you? People have been reached who could not have been reached otherwise. How else would these tough, hardened soldiers have come face to face with someone like Paul, a Christian? See, sometimes gospel growth comes through things that we just see as a distraction. All that time at the hospital, sitting in the waiting room, all that time in the car, going back and forth for appointment after appointment. Think of what else I could be doing with that time, all the useful stuff I could be getting involved in. All that time in work I spent fixing that mess someone else made, and I did it on my own time, and I'm not going to get paid for it. All that money spent buying a new washing machine because the old one broke, and all I get is a new washing machine. I just get back to where I was before, which is having a washing machine that worked. Think of what else that money could have been used for, all the good things I could have put it towards. Paul's message is, remember, when you're living your life for Jesus Christ, seeking to be faithful to him, then whatever situation he places you in, whatever circumstances we find ourselves in, it's not a disadvantage. It's part of God's great plan to advance the gospel. So you've got the palace guard, but then you've also got the Roman church as well. That's the second group of people. He says the Roman church have become more confident. This is verse 14. It says, most of the brethren in the Lord have become more confident by his chains. He's talking there about the church, the Christians in Rome, where he's in prison. There's been something of a ripple effect. As they've seen how bold, how faithful he is as he's in his chains in prison, the church there, the whole church, has just become alive. And now they're speaking without fear as well. A couple of weeks ago on a Sunday evening, I read this statement out from a Chinese pastor who'd been arrested in December. And he'd written this letter before he'd been arrested. One of the striking things he said in that letter was, the communist government is afraid of a church that is no longer afraid of them. Those Chinese believe it's encouraging, isn't it, to hear they're not afraid of the government. They're not afraid of what these rulers can do to them. And that's why they're so bold in China, some of these believers. You know, sometimes I just think to myself, and maybe you do too, why am I still afraid of what other people think of me? Why do I care what they think of me because of my faith and what I believe? Now, these believers in the church in Rome are what I aspire to be. He talks about speaking the word without fear. But then the second roadblock is verses 15 to 18, and that's Paul's rivals, verses 15 to 18. Again, it looks like a roadblock, but it's actually a stepping stone. He talks here about people who preach Christ, he says, out of envy and strife. Verse 16, he talks about them preaching from selfish ambition. So they think they're going to gain something from being gospel preachers. And not only that, they say that they think they can add affliction to Paul's chains. They think they can make things even more difficult and painful for Paul. Now here's what's interesting about this. These are not false teachers. These are not people teaching the wrong way to heaven. You might think that to start with, but actually if it was, Paul would be saying something completely different. When Paul comes across false teachers, people teaching a way that actually ends up in hell rather than heaven, he is very different. He condemns that. He is ruthless in speaking about those sorts of things. Actually, the message they're preaching, he says, is a message that he can rejoice over. He's glad with the message they're preaching. They're preaching the real deal, the real thing. And they're real believers. But they're out to get Paul. And that's strange, isn't it? Remember, these are not health and wealth preachers. Preaching as, you know, give me all your money, driving around in their flash cars. They're not that, because that's a false gospel. They're preaching the real gospel, but out of ambition. Now, Paul doesn't tell us exactly what's going on there. And I think actually he shows a great deal of restraint, because these are people who are trying to make his life difficult. And if it was us, we'd probably be shouting from the rooftops what these people are doing to us. He doesn't go into details about what's going on. But I think it must be this. I think that Paul, he must love being in the spotlight. There he is, in his chains, and everyone's talking about Paul. Everyone's praising him. Isn't he strong under the pressure? He's not giving in. Have you heard about the palace guard? Isn't Paul amazing? And I think they're just jealous. And I think, well, I know. If I preach, then some of that attention will be deflected away from Paul towards me. Well, if that's what they're trying to do, Paul says in verse 18, you know what? That's fine with me. Because it's not about me at all. I'm just glad that Christ's preached. And whoever does the preaching, that's wonderful. Because Christ is truly preached. We got a new board game for Christmas. It's called Forbidden Island. And it's a really good game. You're invited to come around and play it. In fact, if you come to our house, you probably will end up playing it if you're with us for long. It is a fun game. Do you know what's different? Is it's a cooperative game. So you work as a team. You win or you lose this game together. The idea is you're standing on these bits of island and you have to collect some treasures and then escape the island before the ground sinks beneath your feet. But you do it together. You win or lose together. We've had to spend a bit of time working on that whole concept of winning and losing as a team together in our house. That actually, you know what, it doesn't matter if you're the one who gets to pick up the treasure. It doesn't matter if one player picks up all the treasures or not, because you're working as a team. One sign of our maturity as Christians is that we remember and we work that way. We are a team. Because that's something these Christians Paul's talking about, they've forgotten it. They're trying to cause Paul trouble. They see him as a rival. So we can get so easily drawn into seeking our own glory sometimes. That's what these preachers are really after. Deflect the attention away from Paul and onto me. If I have to preach to do it, then fine, I'll preach to do it. I think we find that in all sorts of ways as Christians. I was talking to a friend not too long about the Aberystwyth conference. And I was saying, not that there's any reason that I think this would ever happen, but I was saying, you know what, if I was ever invited to preach there, I'm not sure I'd go. I honestly think I possibly probably wouldn't say yes, because it must be so hard to stand up on a stage in front of a couple of thousand people, or however many it is there, and not start thinking, hey, I'm pretty good, aren't I? Look at me. You know, that must be hard. We can be tempted in all sorts of ways to seek the glory for ourselves, even amongst Christians. You know, I'll just linger on here just a little bit longer so people notice I'm clearing up this mess. I'll just keep my head bowed at the end of the service a bit longer so everyone sees. Of course, I'm praying at the end and I pray for longer than other people. I remember a church when I was much younger where there was a person whose job it was to put their hymns, the hymn numbers up on the board. And you always seemed to make it into a really big job. You used to wait till about a minute before the service started and very solemnly walk to the front and put these numbers up. And you're all going to be watching Colin next week, aren't you, seeing how he does it. It just sort of looked as if he was making himself look really important with his job. He probably wasn't, you know, but it just looked a bit like that. There's a warning here in these verses. Christians, genuine Christians, can do the right thing from the wrong motive. These are real Christians preaching the real gospel, but they're seeking their own glory. And that's so dangerous. And it looked like a roadblock to Paul. If you were looking on, you think, well, that's going to be a problem to Paul, isn't it? These people trying to add even more pain on top of the chains he's already in. Paul says, no, even that preaching, it's a reason to rejoice. I'm just so glad they're preaching the true gospel. What could have been a roadblock is actually a stepping stone, Paul says. And then the third one is Paul's death. Paul's death, and that's verse 19 to 26. So in these verses, Paul goes into some sort of internal dialogue with himself. I don't know if you've ever had that. You've ever been in the kitchen and you start talking to yourself and you're sort of muttering under your breath, should I have the pizza or toast? What do I want? Pizza? And then you just suddenly say quite loudly, oh, I'm going to have the toast. And then someone calls from the other room, sorry, what did you say? And you have that moment where you realise you've been talking to yourself. I suspect we do it quite a lot more than we realise. Now, Paul is having one of these sort of conversations with himself in these verses, except he's writing it down. I don't know if we would do that. We actually verbalise these things. He's writing it down, sort of talking to himself, working through this problem, trying to figure out, well, look, what would I actually want? So in verse 20, he's weighing up life and death. He says, well, look, Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. You know, he's sure about that. Jesus is going to be honoured. That's the big picture. That's not in doubt at all. But then he says to himself, but, you know, which one would I choose? If I could choose to live or die, which would I go for? And that's the context that actually leads to verse 21, that very famous verse where he says, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. He explains what he means by that. Verse 22, he says, if I live on in the flesh, this will mean more fruit from my labour. So that's the advantage. If I live, so bear in mind, remember the context of this verse. When he says, for me to live is Christ, what he's thinking about in particular is going on living and producing more fruit for as long as he lives. But then verse 23 says, but on the other hand, if I die, I go and depart and I be with Christ. And obviously that's far better. I get to be with him. So verse 23 says, I'm hard pressed between the two. Now I'm not suggesting that Paul thinks he actually gets to decide this. This isn't someone considering, you know, suicide, stepping out in front of a bus or something. I think he's just pondering to himself, which one would I choose? Which would I, if I could choose, which would I prefer? And he's worked through his problem. In verse 24, he reaches his conclusion. He says, nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. So verse 25, so I'm confident of this, I'm going to remain. I'll remain here because it will help you all with your progress and joy of faith. And then verse 26, he says, so I'm going to come and see you again. So when he says, for me to live in Christ, is Christ, what in particular he's thinking about is how he can best serve and love and care for those fellow believers. What is this sort of magnificent statement that we love to quote, and rightly so? But actually, when he's saying to live is Christ, he's thinking of some very ordinary things. I'm going to go to Philippi, just so I can encourage them, teach them, bless them. That's why I want to live. I don't know about you, but I find Paul's thought process here just different to mine. And again, I feel like I'd say, Paul here is what I aspire to be, what we should aspire to be, rather than what I fully am. Because if I was weighing this up, thinking, what do I want? Do I want to live or do I want to die? I'd reach the same conclusion as him, but for completely different reasons. I'd be thinking, well, I want to live because, you know, I've got family, I've got people I love, I don't want to leave them, I've got things to do, I've got holidays to go on, you know, I'm happy, you know. You're thinking of all sorts of other reasons I want to live, and, you know, good things about living. Paul's motivation for wanting to live is the church. I want to see the church grow. I want to bless my brothers and sisters. That's why I want to stay alive. He says, actually, if I could choose, I'd love to be with Christ. That's gain for me. He's not being morbid or suicidal when he says he'd choose death. But actually, it's because his love of Christ is so real, so tangible to him. It's a helpful quote I find. It's by Jonathan Edwards, who's a theologian from hundreds of years ago. He says, there's a big difference between knowing that honey is sweet and actually tasting its sweetness. And what you can tell, what comes through when you read these verses, is Paul has tasted. He's tasted for himself that Jesus Christ is sweet. And that's why he's so excited about going to be with his Saviour. The thought is real to him of seeing Jesus. You ever heard people say about someone, do you know what? She's so heavenly minded, she's of no earthly use whatsoever. You ever heard people talking those terms? I think if you'd have said that to Paul, I think he'd have just looked blankly back at you. Because actually, it just doesn't make any sense. Paul here is being heavenly minded. He wants to go and be with Christ. But actually it's his longing for heaven and for Christ that motivates him to stay here, to serve his Christ, to serve the church, to bless God's people. It's his heavenly mindedness that means, again, he's actually demonstrating agape love, sacrificial love. He's choosing what is not his preferred option out of love for his brothers and sisters. Paul says, well, look, either way, Christ will be honoured. You know, to so many people, Paul's death would have seemed like, you know, the death of the church. He is one of the big figureheads, isn't he? The great preacher Paul, who's doing all sorts of good things in Rome, building the church. If he were to die, would that be a roadblock for the church? No, not at all. And you know what, countless times in the history of the Christian church where we've thought, if we lose so-and-so, how could that gap ever be filled? It always is, because it's Christ's church. It's never about one person, however great they might be. It's never about Paul here. It's about the church. It's about Christ's church. Paul's saying, death isn't a roadblock. Actually, Christ will be honoured even in that. So two challenges for us. Here are two challenges to finish. Here's the first one. Is Paul's mindset our mindset? You said Paul's weighing up what decision he would make. And you know, actually, it's not a small thing here, is it? He's talking about it. This isn't, should I eat the toast or shall I have pizza for supper? It's he's talking about whether we choose to live or die. This is an enormous thing. What I want you to notice is the biggest factor for him in making that decision about what he would choose is, what will advance the gospel? What will produce the most fruit? What's best for Jesus? Is that our priority when we make decisions? When you're deciding, where do I go to uni? Should I apply for that job? Should we start a family? Should I retire? Should I go on that holiday? Whatever the decision is, what's best for Jesus? And in particular, Paul's motivation is, what's best for my brothers and sisters? That's what he's thinking about here. Is Paul's mindset our mindset? And secondly, is Paul's confidence our confidence? Do you know, we see all sorts of things today that look like roadblocks, setbacks. You can feel like it on a personal level. You know, you're trying to do something that honours Jesus Christ. You've got that colleague and you're trying to witness to them. And then they go and get a different job. And you think, well, I'm never going to see them again. But I was sitting right next to her every day and having all sorts of good conversations. And what's going on there? Is that a roadblock? You get ill, and all of a sudden, you don't have the energy you used to have. And you are spending that time thinking about medications. Your head is just full of that sort of thing. And you're going back and forth to the doctors and the hospital. And that just replaces all those fruitful things you were doing before. I think we can feel like it at a national level. Are there roadblocks at a national level? Laws that are making it more difficult for Christians just to live as Christians, to live faithful, godly lives. We've got a government that's talking about monitoring Sunday schools, having to register your Sunday school and then they can be inspected. Well, if that happens, that looks like a roadblock, doesn't it? Something that's going to make it more difficult for Christians to teach children about Jesus Christ. And you can see it at an international level as well. Is the gospel disadvantaged when Chinese pastors are imprisoned? When the church as a whole is closed down and about 100 Christians are arrested? Surely that's a setback for the gospel. And that's when we have to remember God's kingdom just doesn't grow like any other kingdom we know. Because God's power in this world is seen through a man hanging on a cross. A display of weakness. Paul says elsewhere, the cross is foolishness to a perishing world. People look at the cross and say, it is so foolish. But to those who are being saved, it's the power of God. So there are no roadblocks in God's kingdom, only stepping stones. I know that might sound like triumphalism. Don't worry about anything. You know, it might almost sound like that health and wealth gospel. As long as you live for Jesus Christ, as long as you give enough, as long as you have enough faith, don't worry, your life will be smooth. No, that's not what we're saying. I know for Paul, the pain of those chains was real. He wasn't saying, don't worry, I'm not actually in prison. No, he was there. He was in prison. He was in pain. But Paul's confident that his chains, not only they're not going to stop the kingdom growing, they're actually contributing to it. Because the very foundation of God's kingdom is the foundation of the work of a man dying on a cross. That's why Paul's so confident. That's why we can be so confident as well. Paul saw it in his chains. He saw it in his rivals. And he saw it even in the possibility of death. Is Paul's confidence our confidence? Well, it can be. It can be. We're going to close and sing. Number 809, when peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll. This is a hymn that talks about how we face all those seeming roadblocks. But then verse 4 says, for me be it Christ, be it Christ hence to live. So we're going to stand and sing 809.